very much for coming. I know you have to be here, but thank you very much for coming anyway. So the McMenemy seminars were originally founded by two students, Chris McMenemy and Andrew Lennon, as a lunchtime seminar series in the Michaelmas term of 1999. And in 2000, unfortunately, Chris McMenemy was tragically killed in a boating accident, and the MCR has voted since then to rename the seminars in his honour. The McMenemy seminars now run on a Wednesday evening before Grad Hall, and they provide the members of the NCR the opportunity to present your own research and also to hear about what other members of the NCR are doing. So they're a great opportunity and everyone should take advantage of that. We cover a broad range of topics during the year, and you should have all received a term card like this in your pigeonholes, which give you the seminars that are happening in Michaelmas, and we look forward to seeing you at those seminars before Grad Hall. Tonight we're lucky enough to have a talk by one of our Trinity Hall research fellows, Dr. Stephen Leonard. Dr. Leonard was appointed as a research fellow of Trinity Hall in 2009 and is a research associate at the Scott Polar Research Institute. His doctoral work examined how linguistic norms and social identities were established in early Iceland and how this identity was reflected in the literature, and he's currently working on a project that he's going to tell us about tonight, documenting and researching the endangered oral traditions of the Inuit people in northwest Greenland. So I will hand it over to him.
Thank you very much. Hope you don't think I'm too overdressed. welcome everybody to Trinity Hall, the best college in Cambridge. I'm going to start by taking you away from black tie dinners and perfect green college lawns and taking you to the top of the world. Here is a short film.
The Pogo Eskimo drum songs, or Behek, are a traditional pre-Christian form of entertainment, created by a people who had no written language with which to impart knowledge or convey feelings or ideas. Today, Ayako Michik, a 67-year-old former hunter and one of the first men to make it to North Pole, is one of the very few who can remember these songs. He is one of just 770 speakers of Inuktitut, or Polo Eskimo, a non-standardized language of sighs and groans where words can be 50 letters long. His people, the Inukhoi, live in the most northern permanently inhabited settlement in the world. For a year, from August 2010, I had the privilege of living there with them. Home for the Inukhoi is the Arctic wilderness of northwest Greenland, the largest island on Earth with a population half the size of Cambridge. This is a place where the sun does not rise for 3.5 months of the year, and the rhythm of each day is determined by only one thing, hila, the word for weather, but also consciousness and mind. Their spoken traditions comprise both drum dancing and, more importantly, storytelling. These stories are of Arctic hunters existing in one of the most hostile natural environments on Earth. The world they describe is bound inextricably to the disappearing sea ice around them. The stories are also a pool of indigenous knowledge about the ice, weather systems, place names, and the sea mammals on which they depend. For Polo Eskimos, there is no one concept of ice, but more than 20 ways of referring to different forms of ice. There are 18 different types of wind, too, but the young people of northwest Greenland are unlikely to be able to name more than a few. They think the life of the hunter is too difficult now. The Polo Eskimos do not believe in man-made climate change. They believe that the weather changes in cycles. That is what their ancestors told them. But if the sea ice disappears, only to return 50 years later, the unrecorded knowledge bound up in their stories will be lost forever, to the detriment of future hunters. These are the last of the Inuit to live this way, travelling by dog sledge and hunting narwhals with harpoons and kayaks. But their world is changing. The glaciers are melting at a faster rate than anybody ever expected, and the movement of animals has become less predictable. The Arctic hunters believe that we have not listened to nature, and now we are paying the price. They think it is time to use our knowledge wisely.
Hanana unika ya tungaru, unika rinyalu ya relepka, kang uonga tamani habishimi itulinga, ak tu namna khwa nu na kabimu kalidaktera. We hope to, uonga namna mektaku gama hoku lushu gama, tu pinganichu uonga dulu. Uonga februami habishimi chipikaktunga, amene yanuami februamilu dinyakto hui kangali akini makdu nanu pinyakaktu. Unuak gupin hu hene tunga, kange iche kat tunga. Behoftu kidda ka tohtu. Tu pakiunga arke takunga lakiunga. Kidda ku kapto, uanga ariyak tunga. Hilame, avishimi, nano khwa. Nuna, nano khwa nuna, unna.
The short story that I began to tell there is my own story. Of my own encounter with a polar bear whilst living in the settlement of Sivicevic in March of this year. The story was told subsequently on local radio shortly before I left the community in August.
Is it possible to have a bit more light?
So the polar Eskimos, they came originally from these settlements here in Baffin and Ellesmere Island. They came in various waves of migrations, the last of which was in the 1860s. And they settled in this corner here for hunting reasons, this corner of northwest Greenland. This is an Arctic wilderness the size of Germany. There's one visiting doctor and there's one policeman. The people with whom I worked for a year call themselves the Inukhwe, the big people. And their self-imposed demonym gives you some indication of their pride. As I said in the film, they are the last of the Inuit to travel by dog sledge on the rapidly disappearing Arctic sea ice, but they're also the last to hunt narwhals with harpoons from kayaks, as you can see here. The sea ice is really the road that connects friends and families between the different settlements, but is also the platform on which their hunting culture depends. One of the threats to their vulnerable minority language is climate change. If the sea ice disappeared, would the people move south and live in the towns in West Greenland as the government wishes? If so, a tiny language such as Polar Eskimo would rapidly disappear as the Inukhwe integrate into much bigger West Greenlandic speaking communities. The glacial sea ice is melting faster than any scientists expected, and the climate has become very unpredictable in recent years. The sea ice used to come at the beginning of September and it used to leave at mid-July. Now, nobody knows when the sea ice will come or how long it will stay for. This year, the expanse of the Arctic sea ice was its second lowest ever recorded in history, the lowest being in 2007. I give the Arctic sea ice 25 years. Then what? Will the polar Eskimos leave the land of their ancient ancestors? Well, I think perhaps not. The bond between the Inukhwe and their land, as I discovered, is special. It's almost spiritual. Young people told me that they would never leave their homeland, and those that do often return shortly afterwards because of reasons of homesickness. The language of the Polar Eskimos is not readily understood by anyone else in Greenland, but it's mutually comprehensible with the dialects of Baffin Island, where they came from. The language, which is known locally as Kanamitun, the language of Karnak, the only town in the region with a population of 650, or Manamitun, the language of here, or Inuktitut or Inuktitut, the language of the people, this is a language that has no standardized written form. It's not the language used in the school, it's not the language of the church, it's not the language of the administration. For this, the Podo Eskimos use the standard West Greenlandic language, which they all speak. The phonology of Podo Eskimo, as I'm going to call it in this presentation, is sufficiently aberrant that there's no real agreement on the simplest of sounds or phonemes. So just to take a few examples here. At the top we have this word, which means very or much, and inuchwachunai, which is a word I'm going to come back to subsequently. It means, it's a traditional greeting, it means hello. If you listen to those two words carefully, they're actually two different sounds, they're two different phonemes, but often written the same as GG or GH, or sometimes differently. The next phoneme, the next difficult phoneme, is this, what we call a glottal stop, which I'll come on to subsequently. But this word, hiokdu, which means, for example, quite different from the West Greenlandic, which is sohdu, or uddume, the word for today, that's written sometimes as DL, sometimes as apostrophe DL, sometimes as apostrophe DD, and so on and so forth. This really tricky word, echrochechachvik, took me a while to pronounce that one, that's the word for laundress. And the question there is, how do you spell these difficult sounds? And indeed, are those two different phonemes, or are they the same? And finally, the chi, as in huhujin, what are you doing? Or uchao later, uchao tapu yahuwa, see you later. Sometimes that's written as TI, sometimes TSI. But on the whole, I would say that's much less problematic. Typologically, this is an Eskimo Aleut language. That means it's related in some form to all the circumpolar dialects spoken by the Inuit people. but it also means, of course, that it's quite distinct from any European language, so you cannot possibly guess the meaning of the words. It does mean that the Inukhui are able to understand certain aspects of dialects spoken in Canada and Alaska, but seldom enough to hold a fluent conversation. Proto-Eskimo is a so-called polysynthetic agglutinative language, which means essentially you take a stem, a verbal stem, and then you add lots of different affixes to it, which qualify it grammatically and semantically, and you end up typically with very long words. So here are a few examples, the top one being particularly useful, today it is very cold. Uddumi ikki nahtuhwa. So uddumi is the word for today. Ikki is the stem, meaning it's cold. Dohwa is an emphasizer, which you can add to almost anything, it just means very or much. The next one down, chiki ba dakiho. So chiki is a stem which means to come, to arrive. Simply means it is said that, it is alleged that, it seems that, and hok is your third person singular. So you can see you can create quite complex sentences with just one word, just by gluing these affixes on the end. Another useful phrase, gyebadalikio. It seems that the climate is getting warmer. It certainly does here at the moment in Cambridge anyway. So the word for hot, gyek, because of the assimilation rules, you can't have a K next to a P, so the K drops, then you add on this affix, patdak, and then the ho, and then you have your whole sentence in one word. Coming back to the cheeky stem again, you can add a different affix, so this affix here, yangichokuhakto. I'm sure that he won't arrive. That affix alone means will certainly not, I don't believe he will. And then my favourite example along the bottom here, which comes from one of my informants, Puludenawa, who is an 88-year-old man and a former hunter, and he once told me, I bakatao kata hama huk lane elane, hano akanisha tane abihu, amit dahiyum pashu wakatao kata hamangit yugama nala hukweya. You have to take a few run up with that one. And I give you the translation now at the bottom. So this is a horribly complex word. It's 49 letters long. But just to break it down, to parse it, you have amitdahi, which means many. Ngu, which means, is actually the part of the verb to be. Kupashua, which means greatly, Kata, that's what we call a grammatical participant. This is just the grammatical bit that tells you that someone's involved. That you there, that single you, is once again the verb to be, or part of the verb to be. Kata is an affix you use if you do something repeatedly. Rama is the verb to have, but in the perfective tense. There are 8 different tenses. Every verb can be applied potentially up to 700 different ways. And then the ichu, if you ever hear ich, you know it's something in the negative, so that's your negator. Ru is an intensifier. And finally, gama, this is a tense that we don't have in English, called the causative, and that's the first person singular. So I won't go into all the grammar behind those different terms and things, but as you can see, this is an exceedingly difficult, complex language. So why did I learn it? Well, let me first of all, before I come on to that, say something about gesture and body language, because this is a language of glottal stops. When I started to tell that story at the beginning, you probably heard me jerking a lot. So a glottal stop is what you have in the Cockney rendition of the word water. Water, water. There's a slight pause there. This language is full of glottal stops, so you never get going. it's very jerky. And I worked with an Australian television crew shortly before I left, and I asked them, how does this language sound to you? And they said, it just doesn't sound like a language. It sounds like a series of jerks and groans and sighs. And I could very much sympathize with that. Merleau-Ponty, the phenomenologist, said that language is gesture. And working in a context where there was no written tradition at all, so this is not a written language, as I said, I came to recognize the gestural and existential significance of speech itself. Impressionistically, one might say that Proto-Eskimo is a language that comes from the stomach or the middle of the body. So the word for yes is simply It's just a creaky expulsion of air coming from the stomach. But it's also a language which is full of body language and gesture. So if you wish to say yes, you just raise your eyebrows. If you wish to say no, a little bit more difficult, you have to pinch your nose here at the top. Took me a while to work that one out. That's maybe. And whole conversations can carry on like this, interspersed with a nalhochwega, I don't know, an ammacha, perhaps, or maybe. Perhaps the two most useful words in the entire language. When I started to learn this language, I was told that in order to master language, I would have to learn to make the sounds of a polar bear. And I came to realise that was fairly correct. I came to learn a language that was, in many respects, extremely rich. There's over 20 different words for rice. There's words such as aligapdok, which is the shadow that forms on the sea ice in the evening in March. There are words such as gannek, which is a certain kind of ice that forms on your eyelashes when the temperature goes below minus 25 degrees. But I also came to understand how language reflects culture. That word that we had there, in a kwachone, that's the traditional greeting that old people use when they meet each other. I mean, it means hello, but literally it means look, there's somebody over there. a common personal name for a man is in a kitchok, which means the place where there's no people. Now, as for my motivation for going there, well, I grew up reading the stories of polar explorers. As a child, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a polar explorer. And as a teenager, this continued for quite a long while, and I started reading everything I could on the Arctic in particular. I was always more interested in the Arctic because I liked the fact that people lived up there. And so I sort of developed this vicarious love of the North, but not really knowing quite what it was all about. And it was some point in my early 20s, so not so long ago, that I came across a book which potentially changed my life, I don't know. But anyway, the book is called The Snow People, and it was written by Wally Herbert's wife, Marie Herbert. Wally Herbert was a British polar explorer. He was the first person to walk across the Arctic Ocean in 1968, and he went with the people with whom I worked. But the reason I got interested in him and the story of his wife was because they lived in this community. They lived there in 1971 and 1972 in this house here. Incredibly, with their 15-month-old baby, they came on the ship and they had enough baby food to last for the entire stay there. There's this fantastic photograph of this mountain of baby food and the three of them. And her book is a beautiful book, but not only is it beautifully written, it describes this community which is extraordinary, which is exceptional, because they've gone out of their way to hold on to the old ways. These are people who don't use snowmobiles, that you can't use a snowmobile in this community. This is a place where they insist on traveling with dogs and hunting in the old-fashioned way. And I became very interested in this community. With the financial crisis in Iceland, my postdoctoral project suddenly looked far less feasible, and I decided quite suddenly that I would take my chance and live that childhood dream that I'd nurtured for many years. The ice is melting and the future of the community and its undocumented language looked in doubt to me. So as I say, on the right-hand side of this hut here, of this slide here, you have his hut where I spent a night in April in temperatures of minus 22 degrees without any heating, just a sleeping bag and an emergency survival sheet. And here we have Wally himself. Now, to get to grips with what is surely one of the hardest languages in the world, I decided I would spend a year there, living in three different settlements and documenting what I could of this unwritten language and of their spoken traditions. In doing so, I became the first scholar to live long-term with the Polo Eskimos since Jean Mallory in 1951, the French anthropologist, and the first linguist ever to have done so. But what was I actually doing there? Well, here are some more explicit objectives. Firstly, I tried to gain a consensus on how the language should be written, i.e. which orthography to use. There are attempts at writing this language, but it's, because it's so unstandardized, it opens the sort of path to lots of sort of miscommunication, and sometimes they even use Danish or West Greenlandish instead on sort of text messaging, for instance. To document as much of the language as possible in terms of grammar, phonology, and lexicon, and I focus most on lexicon, really, because the grammar, fortunately for me, was not so different from the standard language. To document thoroughly their spoken traditions, which are principally drum songs and life stories, which I'll be talking about subsequently, but also to collect evidence on communication patterns within the group using ethnographic methods. Now, for a number of reasons, I had to basically shift my methodological framework of my research. I had wanted to use something called the ethnography of speaking, but after a period of 3 months or so, I discovered that this is a community, or rather a language, where there are no proverbs, where there are very few metaphors, and where the use of language in the conduct of social life was not really key to understanding the society where I was living. The fundamental premise of the ethnography speaking is a relativistic one, the understanding that speaking, like other systems of cultural behaviour, is patterned within each society in culture-specific ways. But it soon became apparent to me that actions spoke louder than words in this community where I was working. It is, of course, true that knowledge and socio-cultural experience are constructed, transmitted, and performed through the filters of storytelling. But really, a more significant medium of instruction and relaying knowledge is actually through actions themselves, or so I came to discover. And elderly people would tell me quite frequently, and one of them told me in particular, she said, there was not much need for language in the old days. And that seemed like such an incredibly important, significant thing that she just told me. And of course, I pressed her on that. And she started saying, well, language, it was only really used directionally. You know, I'm going out hunting, I'm coming home, I'm going there, I'm going here. But not really much more than that. And so from that moment on, really, my interest shifted to sort of pure language documentation. So moving away from this one at the bottom here about analysing communication patterns, but also to developing my own narrative ethnography, which I began to do in my mind. And I discovered that the ethnography came back to me time and time again, not so much the people I was living with, but to myself, because it was obvious to me, and I think also the people where I was living, that my values, my priorities were actually diametrically opposed to theirs. For instance, Polo Eskimos do not assign ontological primacy to the individual, but the group. Existence for them is ostensibly relational. And I found the field work process, it started to become a very sort of highly self-reflexive process. And I began to consider questions of belonging and being. And the words of Malinowski's closing remarks from the Argonauts of the Western Pacific sort of suddenly started to ring true. We cannot possibly reach the final Socratic wisdom of knowing ourselves if we never leave the narrow confinement of the customs, beliefs, and prejudices into which every man is born. Nothing can teach us a better lesson in this matter of ultimate importance than the habit of mind, which allows us to treat the beliefs and values of another man from his point of view. So, as well as my work on documentation of the language and spoken traditions, I found myself considering certain existential questions within the context of phenomenology, the science of experience, or method of reflective attentiveness that discloses the individual's lived experience. Phenomenology is concerned with the relationship between being and being in the world. And I found that fieldwork gave me insights into the whims of human consciousness, drifting sometimes between an ontologically secure sense of self and at other times an overwhelming instability. The fieldwork experience provided me with a sense of consciousness of myself and of my world, a consciousness that was often unsettled and fluid, oscillating constantly between speech and silence, solitude and sociality, frustration and calm, aimlessness and purposefulness. And it showed me that experience is knowledge, and that being human means first that we possess consciousness of ourselves and of our world. Now, these philosophical questions aside, my focus, you'll be pleased to hear, did actually remain on the language and actually learning this language. And of course, the ultimate challenge was to basically learn this language as quickly as possible so that I could do the documentation work. And an awful lot of people asked me, but how on earth did you communicate with them when you got up there? Well, I speak Norwegian, and which wasn't always so helpful, but I Danicized my Norwegian, and I used that initially as a lingua franca with some of the speakers who spoke Danish. Not that many did. But I also crammed standard West Greenlandic, so the standard language, this written language, which is spoken on the West Coast. And you can go to the Language Centre and there are books on West Greenlandic, and that's exactly what I did, learning this language as intensively as possible in the few weeks I left before the Arctic. The people didn't like this. They became angry. They started pushing me around. They said, there was a lot of media fuss about this project before I left, and that got into Greenlandic newspapers, so they knew exactly who I was and what I was doing there. And they said, look, they said, well, you told us that you were here to speak our dialect and not the standard language of what that they see the language as being sort of symbolic of politicians, who people who live in Nuuk, which is 1,000 miles away, and live in an entirely different world where they speak Danish and West Greenlandic and not this language. They don't even understand this language. Most of them have never been this far north before, and they certainly don't know very much about hunting. So they tried to burn my West Greenlandic books, and so I started from zero. And when I say zero, I mean zero. Fortunately, I met a friendly man called Ibi in my first couple of weeks there, and he became a close friend. I met Ibi down by the shore one day, and I told him what I was doing in Danish. He spoke very good Danish, and I said, look, I need some help. And he said, well, there is one text written in this language, which was good to hear. I recorded Ibi reading his text as well as he could. And I listened to that recording 25 or 50 times, time and time and time and time again. And I started to try to write this language down phonetically. And I discovered that was immensely difficult. How do you write phonetically? Even with the IPA chart, it's almost impossible to do. So sometimes I would just write, sounds like the wind blowing down my heater. It got a bit more sophisticated than that. But and then from there, obviously I couldn't just write in phonetic transcription the whole time. I started trying to work out how this can actually be written using the Latin alphabet. And that's not something you can do on your own. Unfortunately, there's a local radio, and the local radio is in the local language, which was an absolute boon for me. So I would go on the radio at the start with a translator, telling people what I was doing. Everyone would listen, and I would get them to start writing down words, and we would discuss them. And then, of course, we got onto this issue of how you spell these words. And even if you don't have a written language, it's amazing how strong people's views are about how words should be written. Suffice to say, you cannot get 100% consensus on this kind of thing. You're doing well if you get 70 or 80, I would say. In terms of, several months down the track, and I was beginning to pick this language up, I started to collect as many words and expressions as I could, and I used a thematic word list that was used for a related Canadian Inuit dialect. And so I started collecting words slowly but surely from a whole massive range of themes, covering everything from kinship, trade, transportation, to climate, hunting techniques, terminology regarding dogs, wildflowers, and so on and so forth. And I eventually ended up with about 150 pages of words and expressions which have never been written down before. Everybody always wants to know how hard and awful it was, so I feel obliged to say something about the challenges. And of course, there were quite a few, and perhaps the most obvious one was 3.5 months of darkness. The sun goes below the horizon for the last time on the 24th of October and rises again on the 17th of February. That creates quite a few problems, as I came to appreciate, one of which was depression, which was something new for me. When the sun comes up, paradoxically, it gets really cold. Somebody else can explain why that is, but and so the temperature in February and March was between minus 30, minus 35 degrees pre-wind chill. So we got down to about minus 42, but that wasn't nearly as bad as the temperature inside my hut, which at once was minus 14 degrees. There were a few problems with polar bears whilst I was living in Civicevic, in the community there. But surely the much bigger problem was actually trying to integrate into what was a very closed, a very inward-looking community, where researchers such as myself were really nothing more than an object of suspicion. I was often asked if I was a spy, and what on earth would I be doing as a spy up there, I don't know, but... many members of the community also felt very exploited by previous outsiders and researchers, and I was forced, therefore, to pay quite large amounts of money to collect data. There were many, many times where I wasn't made to feel particularly welcome at all. There was one afternoon where a schizophrenic broke into my house. There was one evening where a convicted murderer threatened me, and he only eventually left because my house was so damn freezing. But worse than all of that, actually, was for the first 2 months, I was basically ignored by the community. Almost nobody spoke to me, except for these people. And the children were marvellous. They would follow me around the settlement. They would come into my home. Communication, of course, was exceedingly difficult at the beginning, but it's amazing how quickly you do get into some kind of flow. And the children were very kind. They were almost certainly sent by their parents to check out the new guy. Who was he? What was he doing? Because they would come to my house and they'd run around and they'd check everything out and they'd play with my audio equipment and then they'd run off again. But fortunately, they would always come back. I don't want it to make it sound too negative. There were a group of people who were extremely kind to me right from the beginning, and of course they became very close friends, and I'm still talking to them today. I just want to describe a little bit what this place was like, though, because I've never been to a society like this anywhere in the world. The community I'm working in was a static place. This is a place where nothing ever really happens. People don't have ambitions or futures. I would ask young people, what do they want to do with their lives? And they just say, I don't know. It's a place which is ruled by apathy, by disengagement, by the spirit of ammacha, perhaps or maybe. Nothing is ever certain. For centuries, the Polar Eskimos were basically just surviving. That's all they did up until the 50s or 60s. They were just staying alive. That part of the world was such a hostile natural environment. Post-1950s, when they became part of a very generous Danish welfare benefit system, in my view at least, the system of production has been replaced by a very different, a benefit system on which, sadly, about 50% of the community are dependent. I want to say a bit more. I'm sorry this is not very well structured, but there's so much to say in sort of 1 year, and it's from a year's experience, it's almost impossible to get into to a short presentation. But I do want to say something about the storytelling. Globalization, and I've published about this quite a lot recently, but globalization, modernity, and rapid socioeconomic change, it's clear to me, are exposing communities like this to really very complex pressures. The introduction of television in the 1980s and more recent digital entertainment has eroded some of these cultural practices at a very, very rapid rate indeed. The stories, as I said in the film at the beginning, they're really testaments of perhaps the very last Arctic hunters. They're testaments of a life which is bound to this disappearing Arctic sea ice. Nowadays, the stories are primarily life stories. They're not great works of literature at all, but for me, they're more of a sort of way of speaking. They're not remarkable for their literary content, but they're records of really prodigious memories and social history. So one gentleman, not this gentleman here, but Kuludemowak Yeremyasin, this 88-year-old man, he was an extraordinary storyteller. I spent days recording basically his entire life story, and he asked me, where would you like me to begin? I said, well, just begin at the beginning. And so he spent half an hour describing in great detail how he spent his third birthday. Another storyteller told me that he could remember the day he was born. What is important here is that in the absence of any written tradition, knowledge is stored orally, of course, but in quite different ways. And it is extraordinary how what remarkable memories they have. Shortly before I left, this gentleman, Ibbi, who I mentioned to you, he told me that he could remember the day and the time, the exact time, when he first met me down by the shore 11 months earlier. But coming back to the stories, what kind of stories are they? Well, the stories that the men tell are primarily hunting stories, as you might imagine. The stories that the women tell, and women are great storytellers as well, the few that are left, they're talking about sort of life at home, essentially, sewing and cooking and this kind of thing, and how difficult their life was then. And I think all these stories together are really extraordinary records of survival, if nothing else. However, drum singing, as we can see here, and storytelling has become professionalized, become commoditized, and therefore it comes at a price. And really, as an active, live indigenous tradition, it's more or less dead, I would say. Drum singers, they perform on special occasions, they might perform at Christmas time, they might perform for me, they might perform for Her Majesty the Queen of Denmark, who was there whilst I was there. But more often than not, you know, these kind of sort of the old-fashioned sort of coming together and drum singing and storytelling, that's all, I'm afraid, pretty much dead. The shamanic songs, the myths, the old tales, all of that has been lost from Inukhwe memory at some point in the 20th century, probably 60s, 70s. As we saw in the beginning of the film, these drum songs, or bihek, they're traditional pre-Christian songs. They were sung for entertainment. They were accompanied by a very simple drum rhythm of three beats interspersed by a short pause. The drum, which you can see here, is called a pilat. It is small, it's oval-shaped, it's made of caribou antlers, and the membrane is made from the peritoneum of a seal, the lining of the stomach. Most of the songs they sing are extremely simple. Often, many of them don't have any words at all. They might last for about a minute, and then they end when the drum dancer raises the drum and goes, way, 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 in a sort of ridiculous sort of self-congratulatory pose. In the past, they were used sometimes as a means of settling disputes, but they were primarily a form of entertainment. And when the missionaries arrived in the community in 1910, they totally misunderstood these drum songs and what they were about. They assumed that they were shamanic, that they were evil, that they were pernicious constructs, and that wasn't the case at all, in actual fact. And so these traditions were very, very much suppressed. I arrived 100 years exactly after the missionaries turned up, and local people were still reluctant to perform in front of me, primarily for that reason, because it being so suppressed. Right, and I want to talk a little bit about why this matters. Okay, why does the language of such a tiny group of people, 770 speakers, why on earth does it matter? As I said in the film, Polar Eskimos do not, for the large part, believe in man-made climate change. They believe that the weather changes in cycles, that's what their ancestors always told them. What then, if the ice disappears, the knowledge, the stories, it all goes with it, because it's all bound up in these stories, and the ice returns 50 years later, and the hunters no longer have this knowledge. The young people, and this knowledge is not being passed on to young people. These young people will be living in a dangerous world that they won't understand because they would have missed out on this knowledge. That is perhaps one reason, but the other reason is surely the opposite end of the spectrum, and from my perspective, and that is that we are living in a rapidly changing, globalizing world where indigenous knowledge is being lost without record. Okay, most of the world's languages are not written languages. The Pohutu Eskimos, I think, are the canary in the cultural and environmental coal mine, if I can use that metaphor. Globalization and the culture of consumerism are changing indigenous communities around the world and at a very rapid pace. One of my objectives then was to record this knowledge, and in doing so, I hope that the voices of the last Arctic hunters, if they are the last Arctic hunters, will not vanish completely when the ice goes. Just as an example of this, I mentioned in the film there are 18 different types of wind. I've listed some of them here, and I'll just tell you briefly about some of these winds. So at the top, we have the Avannaq. This is a strong wind that comes from the north, the northeast. It comes from Ida, which is now an abandoned settlement right at the top of Greenland. It makes big waves on the water, unlike the Bavanainak, the next one down, which is a wind directly from the north that makes the water flat. Yanilachia is a wind that blows the icebergs and the incipient sea ice away, so you get this wind in October, November, December time. The Kohoranekdok is a wind that blows alongside or down a river. The Kananak is a wind that blows in from the sea and brings fog or mist. This is an important wind because it's the harbinger of summer. About 2 weeks after that wind, you know that the summer is actually going to arrive. The Biganak is the wind that blows down from the mountains and blows the mist or fog away. The Nigek, which is almost certainly the wind that you saw in that film there, and it seems to follow me around everywhere I went. It's a wind that blows from the east or southeast. It brings very low pressure, but it also brings lots of snow. And there used to be much more snow in this part of northwest Greenland, and so the hunters now, they want this wind because if there's not very much snow, the ice crystals, the pakkuk, are very hard on the dog's paws, and so this wind is often very welcome. The Bihuaho at the bottom there, that's a dangerous kind of wind, very dangerous. It brings fog or mist, but it basically brings a whiteout condition. And if you get caught in that, then you are in serious trouble. There are many more winds, and I haven't listed them all here on the slide, but I'll just mention one, the Aduanak, the penultimate one there. That's a wind that blows down the narrow strait between Canada and Greenland. This is where they hunt narwhals, but also walruses. And this wind breaks up the edges of the sea ice, and it frightens the narwhals away. So if you know the Aduanak is coming, then it's not much point going out hunting. I could go on and on and on. There's an extraordinary amount of knowledge regarding winds and weather systems, but the important point is that this knowledge is not being transferred to younger people because they're not interested primarily. This presentation, I think, is called Language, People, and How Things Look from the Top of the World. And now comes the sort of serious bit, where I talk about the view from the top of the world and how things are looking from their perspective, but also perhaps from mine. I think after having spent a year in this remote community, which speaks this extraordinary language and whose cultural foundations are being rocked by climate change, it is clear to me, in fact, that there's a link between cultural and environmental vulnerability. And that it's genuine and that it is interwoven. Cultural practices of the Pohutu Eskimos are based on a history of survival strategies in one of the world's most hostile environments. The language and the way of speaking is a representation of that. I've never met anybody who is indifferent to the elimination of animal species or biodiversity, but linguists and anthropologists are still being asked to defend linguistic diversity and cultural diversity. In doing so, it should be remembered that language is so much more than a syntactic code. To treat language as such is to reduce it, in my opinion, to its least interesting features. To know the meaning of a word is not just a question of acquiring an appropriate phonetic motivation, but it involves a familiarity with an entire universe of meaning where language and society interpenetrate the lived value of words. When languages die, we do not just lose words, but we lose different ways of conceptually framing things. So there's no one word for ice for the Pohutu Eskimos, but there are 20 different ways of referring to various forms of ice. So through different representations in meaning, through different distinctions in meaning, languages provide insights into how different groups of speakers know the world. A language is a collection of statements about this world, delivered in a multitude of voices set to a background of music. each language of the world requires a different voice. And when we lose a language, I think we lose an orchestra of voices that permeate the mind. As well as knowledge and perceptions of the world, which are built into local language varieties, we lose the music and poetry of words which elicit so much pleasure. So there should be no need, in my opinion, to defend linguistic diversity. It and the power of language is really something to be celebrated, and without it, the world, I think, would be utterly dull. But standing at the top of the world, it occurred to me that actually there's something more important. There's something more important than linguistic diversity. Before I left for the Arctic a year ago, a lot of friends told me that the experience would change me as a person. I don't think that's the case, fortunately or unfortunately. But it's true that I don't think I'll ever be able to look at life in quite the same way again, because living in the Arctic confirmed, in actual fact, what I suspected for a long time, and that is it opened my eyes, really, to the lunacy of the congested and overpopulated world where we live, and where people have real no concept at all of what nature or wilderness is. The society I was living in was not an ideal at all, far from it. There were many things I didn't like about it, but it did show me what life must have been like in a pre-industrialized society. It showed me what life must have been like in a world before man had left its mark on it. At the beginning of this journey, I wondered if I might end up taking up the indigenous cause. After a year of living with Yinakwi, I have no intention of doing that. Instead, I do feel strongly that environmentalism has to now take a front seat in policy making around the world, and that now is time for radical solutions to enter the mainstream. Now, what I'm now going to tell you is probably going to make no sense at all, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because it's the only important thing I have to say today. My diary entry for the day when I came down from the north after a year on August 9th, 2011, reads as follows. I return today to what many people call civilization. I have spent much time thinking about how I would readjust to my old life and whether there would be any difficulties in doing so. The plane touched down at Kastrup Airport in Copenhagen at 9 p.m. It was just getting dark, and after 4 months of 24-hour sunshine, the return to a more regular balance of day and night was very welcome. With 75 kilograms of luggage and a pair of skis slung over my shoulder, I staggered out of the airport and was struck by the stifling humidity. After having lived in a polar desert for a year, the sweat poured off me as my Turkish taxi driver negotiated the busy streets of the Danish capital. I dropped my bags off at the hotel, walked down one of the main boulevards, and sat quietly on a bench. I'd often speculated how this moment would feel. Even though I had returned to the world I knew, I felt in a sense displaced and overwhelmed. The sky rumbled with the incessant noise of aeroplanes overhead. One after the other, streams of traffic poured past me in both directions. The pavements were almost empty. The only sign of life were fixed heads behind steering wheels moving horizontally and swiftly, as if on a conveyor belt on the wrong gear on an assembly line of environmental destruction. It was the dream of Anne-Sophie Amina, a 13-year-old girl who visits me every day and from whom I learned much of their language, to leave northwest Greenland and to come and live in Denmark or England. Not having ever left the land of the Polo Eskimos, she spoke of this precarious journey all the time. But having lived in the Arctic wilderness, having lived in a pristine environment where man has barely left his mark, I would be ashamed and embarrassed to show her my world of progress, development, and unsustainability. A world of industry, high-rise buildings, noise, polluted skies and rivers, a place where childhoods are spent in the back of cars on clogged streets. And yet it does not have to be like this. We can live in sustainable ways, which are simple and very gratifying. Despite what we know, any sense of an environmental consciousness seems to be completely absent. I walked back to the hotel and fell asleep to the sound of a car alarm. Now back at home, of course, and now acclimatised to the relative heat and humidity, I do at times feel like a lone voice in a sea of madness. Living with the Polo Eskimos, I pursued a childhood dream. The year had its ups and downs, of course, but I have absolutely no regrets. I'm an idealist, and with the Arctic environment, I think I finally found my cause. In a way, I now see it as my duty to tell the world how things look from the lens of those living at the top of it. The Greenlanders have known for decades that the climate is changing rapidly, but their voice has not been heard. If I could wish one thing, it would be for the Arctic wilderness that I came to know and love to be left as it is. However, the so-called code rush is now moving into its next phase. Nation states are preparing to lay claim to the last remaining fossil fuels that lie beneath the Arctic's disappearing ice. 25% of the world's unexplored fossil fuels lie in the Arctic, a vulnerable and unspoiled part of the world, and the demand for these finite resources is rising year after year. With the Arctic sea ice gone, shipping lanes will, I think, transform the world and will open up across the Arctic. And so goods will be shipped from Greenland to China, going right across the Arctic Ocean there, which is currently ice. The journey between East Asia and Western Europe is 13,600 kilometres using the Northwest Passage, which is the blue line on the map, but 24,000 kilometres if you use the Panama Canal. In 2007, the Northwest Passage was opened during the summer for the first time ever. The Northern Sea Route, which is the green line on the map here, is also becoming a possibility. To preserve the Arctic environment and to put the brakes on climate change, the two issues of population growth and consumerism will have to be tackled. The year I was born, and I'm not telling you when that was, there were 3.5 billion people on Earth. Today, there are 7 billion people. Combined with this unprecedented trend, humanity's obsession with economic growth is destroying the planet's finite resources. Our habit of excessive consumption might give short-term satisfaction, but denies long-term fulfillment. There will be some difficult and unpopular decisions to make, but we have to now learn from the Polar Eskimos and stop ignoring the knowledge we have. Today, the problem of climate change is on the doorsteps of the Polar Eskimos. In 25 years, in my opinion, the problem will be one that we all share. In the meantime, we should remember the words of the Polar Eskimos themselves. Nalab dunget digim, hielang narab dunget digim, hio nihyahu unga hishyo, onig dog go. Be kind and respectful. Be careful as we march towards an uncertain future. Thank you. I think the time to go back will be when I've written all this up, when I've worked out what the gaps are in terms of the book on language documentation, and I'll go back and talk to them further. I think if I go back, actually, life will be so much easier, because they're used to people coming and leaving and they'll never see them again. And they're very sensitive people. They're extremely upset if you leave and you don't come back. So there was this sort of hysteria before I left, which went on for 3 or 4 weeks, and I was constantly asked, when are you coming back, when are you coming back, when are you coming back, sort of 20 times a day, so I'll go back at some point.
Is the language of Polar Eskimos, is it being overwhelmed with other words? Are they adapting for West Greenlandic words, or are they adapting more Danish words?
I don't think it's being overwhelmed at all, and I think it's there are relatively few Danish and West Greenlandic words in this language. Purely because of the extreme geographical isolation. Although these people had almost no contact with anyone prior to the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, there were some whalers and the odd traders, but it was only really when the explorers came and the missionaries came that there was influence on their language, but very, very few outsiders ever took the time to learn it. So in a way, I think it's a fossil, it's a linguistic fossil, it's as part of the interest.
Okay, thank you very much again. I would just like to start.